There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
Hi, this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 164. This is recorded on the evening of March 20th, 9 days after Japan suffered an incredibly large earthquake, followed by a tsunami tidal wave that affected a major portion of the northeast coast. And oh, by the way, part of the affected facilities in that northeast coast were two nuclear power stations, one of which has had some significant difficulty during a 1 week-long station blackout, ensuring that all of the parts of the facility have received adequate cooling water. Appears that most of the situation is stable, and the operators are doing their job in making sure that all parts of the facility are properly cooled and they're restoring electrical power. I gathered a group of pro-nuclear bloggers who have been very active trying to share information, and I'm going to go ahead and start the show with a little bit of the introduction that we go through when we're getting together. So I hope you enjoy, and this is a little bit longer, almost an hour and a half. So invest your time wisely. I hope you'll enjoy the show. Bye.
And what I will do is I'll introduce you guys, and then we'll start the discussion. Obviously, we're going to talk about some of the interaction that we have had and some of the ways that all of us have gotten out and tried to figure out how to communicate to the world what we're seeing and how we were sharing information with each other to try to understand what was going on in the face of very understandably sketchy information coming from the Japanese. Because as I keep trying to tell people in as many places I can, don't forget, these folks had a lot of other things on their mind rather than feeding the U.S. News media with information on a daily or hourly or minutely basis on what's happening to their slow-moving developments in their reactor plants. All right. This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number something. I can't remember what it was. I'll figure it out later. It's been quite a time since March 11th. I have with me some distinguished guests who have been very active in the last week sharing information about nuclear energy, both amongst themselves, with other nuclear experts, with other Nuclear Institute folks, and then getting out talking about their knowledge with the public. With us today is Meredith Angwin, who blogs at Vermont Yankee.
Hi, Rod. Happy to be here.
Who blogs at Yes Vermont Yankee. I'm sorry. Meredith has nothing to do with Entergy and is not employed by Entergy. She's merely she's a wonderful physical chemist who learned a lot about nuclear energy and moved to Vermont for various personal reasons and has found herself in a battle to try to help people understand why there is a nuclear power plant in Vermont and why it should remain in Vermont and remain operating. We also have Gwyneth Cravens, who is the author of Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. Wonderful book, and Gwyneth has been really out there trying to help people understand what she has learned as a former anti-nuclear activist who protested against Shoreham. Gwyneth went on a journey of knowledge discovery that lasted about, 10 years, Gwyneth?
Yeah.
And so she's working on another book. She hasn't really told me much about that. Suzanne Hobbs, or Susie Hobbs, is with us. Susie is an artist, a wonderful, talented visual and literary artist who is the daughter of a nuclear engineer and spent her childhood sitting around the dining room table learning about all kinds of interesting engineering topics and has decided to employ her art to try to talk about or discuss or communicate in as many ways she can what she knows about nuclear energy. Margaret Harding is with us. She is a consultant.
Complete nutcase.
Well, a complete nutcase. Margaret and I both share about a 30-year history in working in the nuclear business. Margaret is a nuclear engineer by training and by employment. Worked for about 28 years or something for a very large and talented a large multinational corporation, and she can decide if she wants to express that corporation's initials or not. But and then Dan Yerman is the blogger at Idaho Samizdat. He is also a force behind the ANS Nuclear Cafe and ANS and the American Nuclear Society. That's ANS social media efforts. Dan has been organizing meetings at ANS meetings and has organized a very useful and informative email list that's probably burned up the servers in the last week called ANS Social Media. So welcome to you all. And now that the introduction's over, I decided not to let you introduce yourselves today. I will. What I do want to do is have you each say your name and let people kind of match your name and your voice, so they'll have an idea who's talking when. So start with Meredith.
Meredith Angwin. That's my name.
Okay. Gwyneth.
Gwyneth Cravens.
And Susie.
Susie Hobbs here.
And Susie's having a little trouble with her microphone, so we've asked her to try to stay muted most of the time, but we want her to talk when she has something to say, please. All right, Margaret?
Margaret Harding.
And Dan?
Dan Yerman.
Dan, you sound like you've been talking a lot recently. Maybe, I don't know. A little bit hoarse there. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Dan is also can I say this, Dan? I'll ask your permission first.
Well, you can call me Grandpa Dan.
Okay.
In the middle of all this, my son and daughter-in-law had twin baby girls on Wednesday. Mom and babies are doing fine and came home this weekend.
Congratulations, Dan. I just spent a wonderful weekend with my 14-month-old granddaughter, and it was a gorgeous spring weekend here in Lynchburg, Virginia. Went out to playgrounds, and it's just a really wonderful thing to share that with her and push her in a swing. And anyway, all right. So about a little over a week ago, on March 11th, the nation of Japan was struck by a devastating earthquake, followed by a very large tsunami tidal wave that has caused a great deal of death and destruction on the northeast coast. And in the middle of the hit zone, there were two nuclear power stations, Fukushima Daiichi and Fukushima Daiichi, that's how I think that I pronounce it. And both of those power stations are multiple unit stations. I think Daiichi has, what, four units? Is that right, Dan?
I believe so.
And then six units at Daiichi.
Daiichi.
I need to – somebody told me I needed to learn to pronounce Japanese words a little better. So.
Why?
Daiichi. Is that better? No.
Daiichi and Daiichi.
Daiichi and Daiichi. Okay.
I can't say much in Japanese, but
like
I got that one.
Which is like one and two, right? Or first and second?
Yeah, it's essentially, the way it's described at the company that I work at that shall remain nameless, when we worked on these plants, it was Fukushima 1. One Fukushima 2 would be the unit 2 at the first site. So that would have been Fukushima Daiichi 2 in the current language. So, yeah, it's one and two, the smaller number of units being the Daiichi site, which is the second site built.
Okay. So Daiichi shut down and apparently didn't have too many issues after the tsunami. Managed to get the four units there into safe shutdown condition, which in the nuclear world means shut down and cooled down to a point where there's no real issue, no real chance of boiling when you don't want to boil and that kind of thing. Daiichi, though, suffered a massive power failure as well as being shaken around and then washed over by a very large amount of water. And so I believe that the power failure lasted essentially a week. And a nuclear power station suffering a station blackout has some significant challenges to face that requires the creative response of human beings, operators who have to get in there and as somebody once said in a famous movie, improvise, adapt, and overcome. So, Dan, what you been up to this week?
What I've been doing and why I haven't been posting on my blog is that I've been working as a contractor supporting the American Nuclear Society blog, ANS Nuclear Cafe. Friday morning, the 11th at ODARK 30, I got a call from ANS. There's an emergency in Japan, and we need to start putting news information on the ANS Nuclear Cafe. We repurposed that blog for that purpose and began posting a continuous stream of news items through Sunday. On Sunday, we had over 50,000 page views. Blog normally tracks 400 to 800 page views, so you get an indication of the level of interest. I want to mention my colleagues at ANS, Laura Sheely in the outreach department, Rick Michael, an editor, and Joe Koblich in the IT department, without whom this would not have been possible.
And it has been. I think one of the things that we want to talk about is the huge difference between having a nuclear incident level 5 in 1979 and one in 2011. And that's part of it. The ANS really came and began sharing a lot of very useful and valuable information to a large number of people who could then use that to spread the word in a sort of viral manner.
Another thing we had going, Rod, and this is not generally known, and I'm going to just talk about in general terms, is that since January of 2010, there's been a private discussion list of senior nuclear people, people interested in social media and so forth, which remains private and will not be public, which has been discussing this issue. And out of that has come real leadership in terms of bringing a message of sanity and clarity to what is going on. One of the people on this call tonight, Margaret Harding, has been ahead of that train. And I can't tell you how much I admire the work that she has done.
Yeah, and some of you may have seen Margaret. She's our celebrity in the group. She's, well, one of the celebrities.
Oh, please.
She's been on national TV several times sharing a message of calm, technical competence in the face of an awful lot of what almost appears to be pre-prepared disaster scenarios by people who have an agenda, who apparently really wanted us to have an amazing disaster so they could further their agenda. But
I have to tell you all a funny story. My son is over in Switzerland on an assignment with school, and we Skype with him periodically to say hi, and we were Skyping tonight, and I was telling him about my wild sleigh ride of a week, and he said, "Were you on the Sean Hannity show Monday?" I said, "Yes, son, I was." And he said, "Oh, wow." He said he hangs out on a progressive blog, pro-nuclear progressive blog somewhere, I don't know. And he said they were talking about the Sean Hannity show and how so usually it's so insane, but that there was this panel on Monday night, and they were so logical about the whole thing. And he said, "It wasn't you, was it?" And I said, "Yeah, sweetie, it was me."
Well, we are proud of you, and I think that you did. I have not paid much attention, quite honestly, to the broadcast or even cable news media. I've been kind of busy myself, so I have watched a few clips here and there. And part of it was I just couldn't stomach watching Ed Lyman anymore. But
well, yeah, I actually can't stand watching myself on TV, so this has been an experience of carefully avoiding the shows I might be on, which would be good, and then avoiding all the rest of them because it makes me mad. And then I was trying to be rational, so I didn't want to get angry, so I just didn't watch TV.
Well, that's always good advice anyway.
So, oh, yeah.
I think the best advice for people is read blogs and listen to podcasts.
Works for me.
And I'm perfectly selfish when I say that.
And you do know one of the interviews with Fox News, I actually told them that I don't listen to mainstream media on the air.
Which always gets a blast of silence when you're on mainstream media, right?
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but apparently there was the interviewer got a – because it was a Skype interview. I very rarely actually see anybody in all of these things I'm doing. I have never actually seen the person I'm talking to. And apparently she got this just completely nonplussed look when I said that.
Yeah. So, Susie, you are a representative of a completely different generation here. The rest of us are old. So I hope that doesn't insult anybody else, but Susie, what have you been up to?
Well, I've been trying to reach people like myself who've never personally experienced a nuclear crisis on this magnitude with information that is relevant to the concerns of young people. So like you and many others, I've been blogging away and sharing links to accurate as we have information, and just trying to keep communication open, answer questions, and offer support in any way that I can. In the past, I think incidences like these have really directly affected the industry. So it's my hope that my generation will be the first to say, okay, we can put this into perspective and move forward.
Yeah, we can, in fact, as a society, survive what people described as a nuclear catastrophe and move on. That's my hope, because, in fact, I think that there's a lot of very positive information that can come out. Unfortunately, and I want to make sure people don't consider me insensitive. I have a great deal of empathy for the folks who are trying to get food and water in the face of a natural disaster. I grew up in South Florida, went through several hurricanes as a young person. I lived in Charleston, South Carolina when Hurricane Hugo devastated the town. Have a humanitarian service medal to prove that I was active in the cleanup after that. And my family was in South Florida during Hurricane Andrew, and I was in Annapolis, Maryland during Hurricane Isabella. So I have some understanding and empathy of what happens in an area once the power goes out. And when power goes out, things get really nasty really fast.
Well, and I think that was a point that you brought up and much of the community supported, was that we needed to focus on meeting the humanitarian needs before we focus on the nuclear issue. Even when we had the least amount of information and the most concern, there were still bigger issues at hand that needed to be dealt with. And the mainstream media, I think, lost sight of that at some point. And it's hard to know what kind of damage that has caused, but, you know, I'm glad that there were a few folks trying to rein everyone back in and stay focused on dealing with the biggest issues first and keeping our priorities straight.
Yeah, you know, I have a number of friends with friends in Tokyo, and I spent a long time IMing with one of them last night or the night before, and even the Chinese media was jumping on the panic and disaster. This gentleman is from the Midwest, but has lived in Tokyo for 10 years and is married to a Japanese woman. They have kids. And his wife was freaked out and ready to run from Tokyo to Korea because she thought they would be safer. And fortunately, my sister-in-law, who's this man's friend, said to him, wait, I got somebody you need to talk to. And I pointed him to that Plain English Nuclear blog to start with, and then he and I had a long discussion on IM about what was really happening, and that Tokyo, 170 miles away, he did not need to worry, and that he should not just turn off the TV, just stop listening. If that's what they're telling you, just don't go there, and concentrate on the real disaster and the people that have been displaced and their homes washed away and family members lost, and help them get back on their feet. The nuclear thing is just a little puff of smoke, and don't worry about it.
Yeah, and one of the things that really is concerning to me right now, is, as of today, is this report of very minor levels of iodine found in milk and spinach. One of the worst things imaginable to me is for perfectly good food to be dumped in a place where we have very little ability to resupply right now. The logistical nightmare has not stopped. You know, that whatever levels of iodine have been discovered are far less danger to human health than not eating.
Absolutely. And I don't know how to express the frustration of when people spread FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt to try to make a point about an event. And it kind of goes back to the discussion that some of us have had earlier about my optimist conundrum. It's so much easier to say it's going to fail than to stand up and say, no, it's not.
What's concerning to me, Margaret, on that, and we've had some discussion on this, is
I know.
I don't understand why some people think that you gain more credibility if you say something might fail and it doesn't fail.
It's not more credibility. It's the game of they get to say, well, you know, lucky, or you had some talented people that pulled it out, or you had the dedicated Fukushima 50 that saved the day. And the problem is that it's the boy who cried wolf at some point, but it's getting people to understand that they're continuing to cry wolf. And what makes me just supremely happy is people like Susie and my son of that younger generation get it. And they're listening to it and saying, this is not true. And that just makes me feel like it's going to be okay, because they get it.
I think my generation has been bombarded with so much media and entertainment and internet since the time we were really young, that we've had to start discerning fact from fiction for ourselves and become a little bit more critical of the things that we're constantly exposed to. So, yeah, I agree. I think it's a very different situation than in the past, because we have a lot more options of where to get our information.
Yeah, Susie, on that wonderful blog that you wrote, what was the name of the...
Kaya Cabrones. It's a group of artists and different creative young people in Atlanta. So they review music and art exhibits and things like that, and deal with a lot of different contemporary issues.
And one of the things that you posted on that was very moving to me. I mean, you're a second generation who, or your father was a nuclear engineer. My father was an electrical engineer.
Yeah, I am.
Sorry, for the local utility company. I'm having a little bit of difficulty saying this, but you know, Dad got up every one morning every month to go to storm training. Because that's what utility workers do. You get ready for disaster, and you're part of the system. You know, when people are, I'm a systems technology guy. I never claim to be an engineer. You know, I don't have a PE. I have worked as a operating engineer, but as a systems guy, I continue to remind my colleagues that people are part of the technological system in place. You know, we cannot anticipate all possible things, and so we have to design systems that allow people to improvise, adapt, and overcome unforeseen circumstances.
You know what's really interesting is in all of my rather public things, I get information from old friends suddenly reappeared on my horizon. It's like, oh wow, Margaret was in the news. But I'm finding out they're going to ask me for money next. But
well, you can share some of your appearance fees.
They can have 100% of them. And the funny story about that is when I didn't appear on CNN Wednesday night last week, they were terribly embarrassed. Libya got in the way. And frankly, that was right as the whole infighting between the American government and the Japanese government came out. And I did not want to get in the middle of that one. So I was actually quite pleased that I wasn't going to be on the air. And they said, oh, we're so sorry. It's like, it's okay. I was like, well, we'll pay your expenses. No, guys, you already sent the car. You already paid for the makeup. I'm good. Just let me go, please. Anyway, I digress. Back to the point. People came back to me and said, do you understand that some of these things we're watching happen that look ad hoc, like they're kind of making it up as they go, those are actually in the playbook. Mm-hmm. The spraying of water on by the fire trucks, which just looked completely Keystone Cop, was a plan developed for in case a plane crashed into the top. And you couldn't get back up there. How would you get water into the spent fuel pool? And they trained and figured out how you aimed the nozzles so that you got water where you wanted it to go.
Right, which is one of the reasons why I was completely taken aback, from a technological point of view, trying to dump water from a helicopter at 300 feet or more above a spent fuel pool. And saying that you're going to put water in the pool is completely absurd.
But there was a reason for it. There was a different reason for it. Did you know that?
I heard what somebody said, and it's a bunch of crap, because that only would happen if there was radionuclides to wash out. And there were none.
They found there is, if you read carefully, they are having issues with laying the electrical line because there's local contamination on the ground around reactors 3 and 4, which would coincide perfectly with that scenario.
Where did the radioactive material come from?
There was probably release from the pools. It wasn't on fire, but if it heated up enough, the cladding would flake off.
Heating up enough to something above the something below the boiling point of water?
No. If there was no water in the pool,
but there is water in the pool.
No, not they. Well, let's not get into the argument, Rod. But the scenario actually makes some sense. If there was not sufficient water, if it was partially uncovered, it would have some cladding failure above where it was exposed. Then you would have some radionuclide escape, and the spray from the helicopters would definitely scrub the air.
Rod, this is Dan. I want to jump in here and talk about NRC Chairman Gregory Jasko's testimony about the spent fuel pool at number 4, because it was the basis for a fairly significant decision that he made in the context of his congressional testimony on Wednesday. He testified before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. He told the committee that he recommended that Americans in Japan evacuate to a distance of 50 miles from the Fukushima reactors. Earlier in the week, Japanese officials had ordered an evacuation to a 20-kilometer radius, that's about 13 miles, around the reactor. Jasko's statement essentially quadrupled the size of the potential danger zone. He said the basis for the recommendation is that there was core damage to 3 of the reactors. That wasn't very specific, and I'll come back to that in a minute. He added that there were additional threats of health effects to plant workers and the general population from dangerous level of radiation. Here's a short quote. Quote, we believe that secondary containment has been destroyed and there is no water in the spent fuel pool. And we believe that radiation levels are extremely high, which could possibly impact the ability to take corrective measures. Now, I'll mention also that Japanese officials in government and TEPCO executives immediately disputed JASCO's remarks and his recommendation for wider evacuation. Japan's nuclear safety agency, TEPCO Electric Power, which operates the complex, denied water had gone was gone from the pool. Utility spokesman told the Associated Press the same day, quote, condition is stable at Unit 4. There's a lot of questions about what did JASCO know, when did he know it, and on what basis did he make that decision to have the much wider evacuation?
And see, my problem is I know a little bit, actually I know a little bit more than a little bit, about how spent fuel pools are designed and what it means to be seismically qualified as a system structure and component that is able to withstand the shaking of an earthquake. And there was nothing to indicate that the spent fuel pool had any damage that would cause it to lose water, which would, again, part of the reason we have the QA system we have on nuclear plants around the world is to give us confidence that we know how the strength of materials work. And please, for the listeners, engineers in general, given the opportunity, will make things 3 inches thick if they know that 1 inch thick is what you really need. Because as long as nobody tells us we can't spend that much money, we will spend it because we don't like things to fail.
On that point, let's talk about some information that's come in from the nuclear industry from various sources during the week. We know we have a pretty good idea the concrete on one side of the pool fell away and that this may have occurred from one of the hydrogen explosions. We also have information that the pool has a 1.5-inch steel liner, which is believed to remain intact, which means the pool's likely not leaking. Now,
right. It's a 1.5-inch steel liner. And there are no penetrations below the water line because
There's no drain. Now, the issue of core damage is also important. And Chairman JASCO mentions this in his testimony. So let's define what he's talking about. What he's probably talking about are fuel assemblies in reactors 1 through 3, which may have deformed from heat. But since he's actually seen them, their condition remains unknown. The term core damage does not mean that reactor pressure vessels have cracks or that the primary containment structure has been breached in some way. And the reason for this is that we have declining levels of radiation rather than increasing levels of radiation in the area, although Margaret pointed out there is contamination on the ground. So it's very important to understand what core damage means and also to look at the structural integrity of the pool relative to the chairman's assessment.
It's also important for people to understand, and Margaret, you may be able to help me out on this. I would venture to say that at least some of the advisors, if any, he may have gone independently as far as I know, but at least some of the advisors are of the training that if you uncover fuel rods, you have core damage. They are not trained to understand the boiling water reactors, which always have uncovered fuel rods.
Well, no. The way the boiling water reactor works is that you always have a film of liquid on the rod. The steam is moved into channels away from the rods themselves. So, yes, there's steam in there, but there's always water on the rod, because otherwise it's going to overheat.
Okay.
We're well aware of there's limitations to how well you can model. So there's a lot of real conservatisms in the assumptions for failure, simply because it's very difficult to be accurate in that kind of a best described as chaotic environment. You've got steam, you've got water, you've got fuel. It's hard to explain it all, but there is a known phenomena that when ZERK is exposed to air or steam, it gets warm, it will oxidize quite quickly. It could be described as a fire. That's not accurate. But that's when you talk about the core damage. Most likely, what happened there is if it gets above about 500 degrees C. I think it's C. Yeah, C. in steam, it will start to scavenge oxygen from the water and oxidize and fail. It gets a puffy, loose, poorly adhesive characteristic, and it just literally flakes off. At that point, then you start to get lots of excess hydrogen because you're stealing the oxygen. Now you start to understand where the hydrogen bubble comes from.
Yeah. Well,
people have asked me if I think the core melts, and I said, I don't know, and I don't actually care, which gets me double takes. And because the answer is the isotopes that you care about were released when the cladding failed.
Right. Because the isotopes that you care about, they're gaseous at that temperature.
Right.
Like cesium is a relatively low melting point, low boiling point metal.
Right.
So it does become a gas at relatively low temperatures. I think somewhere in the neighborhood of 650 degrees C, if I'm not mistaken, is when cesium becomes a gas. But I'm not sure if any of you had a chance today to read my blog entry. I found a very interesting video where a TV station in Berkeley, California, picked up the phone and called their local university and said, we're hearing about these Zirk fires. Can you help us understand what we need to be worried about? And they found a couple of researchers who actually had some zircaloy tubes in their lab. They put on a mask, put the tubes into a chamber, and tried to burn them with a blowtorch, elevating the temperatures of the zircaloy tubes to 2,000 degrees C, and were not able to burn them.
Yeah, I watched that video too. I also watched an explosion of zirc at the facility here.
Ground-up zirc or zircaloy tubes?
It was zircaloy dust that exploded.
Well, dust is something completely different.
I understand, but the point is it can catch fire. What they did there demonstrated that it's not easy. And when you read the reports that were done a long time ago, the odds of a fire in a BWR spent fuel pool in particular are extremely low and require a very precise organization of relatively fresh and exposed fuel to get the precise temperatures and the precise chemical conditions to cause it.
Right, and the fuel that was removed and stored in Unit 4 pool was removed from a reactor 100 days ago.
Right.
And it is a low-density storage, not a high-density storage.
Right.
Well, this is Dan again. I want to come back to this issue of exactly how did Chairman Jasko know that there was a problem with that pool. First, let's talk about his interaction with others, and then we'll talk about some temperatures. The important question, I think, is who did he talk to get his information? He just didn't make this up, pull it out of the air, and then
really?
Show up at Congress and start talking. Obviously, Chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to talk to a lot of people before he testifies before Congress. Let's step through who he might talk to. First of all, Jasko told the NRC, the Congress, that the NRC is staffed around the clock with nuclear experts monitoring the crisis in Japan, and that a number of NRC staff are actually over there on the ground. So the first question is, what information from Operations Center and the people in Japan did Jasko use to develop his testimony? Here's another question. Did the NRC chairman consult with the other four NRC commissioners before delivering his congressional testimony? They're all much more senior than he is. They have deep body of knowledge of nuclear expertise and could have contributed to his understanding of the rapidly unfolding events. Did the NRC chairman consult with his counterparts in the Japanese Nuclear Safety Agency and with TEPCO officials? So these are very important human questions. And let me go to the issue of temperature. The question is, how did Jasko know that the pool was empty? And the first question
let me rephrase that. How did Jasko think he knew the pool
was
empty?
All right, fine. Okay, let's start with the fact you couldn't walk up to the pool and take a look. So you have to use remote sensing. And one of the things we know is that we have satellites and aircraft-mounted instruments that would have been able to get an approximate or inferred measurement of the temperature of the remaining water, if any, in the pool, which was open to the outside air as a result of the hydrogen explosion. Once you know the temperature there, you can make an assumption about what's going on with the fuel. For instance, at one point last week, TEPCO released data saying the last known temperature of the pool was about 180 degrees Fahrenheit. This means you could cook a chicken in it, but it's not going to boil off. The boiling point at normal atmospheric temperature at sea level is 212 degrees. Now, infrared remote sensing is available from Earth orbiting satellites. Japanese have them, we have them, and it would be obvious to a trained photo interpretation analyst, if there was no water in the pool, the temperature of the fuel assemblies could be inferred to be well above 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's a possibility. Now, another thing that's important to know is, what if the pool was leaking? Now, we've talked about earlier that there are no penetrations to the steel liner, but let's suppose for the sake of discussion that there was. Under normal circumstances in a nuclear facility, the discovery of water leaks where they don't belong triggers a cascade of communications. In abnormal conditions, it's impossible to predict what might have happened if there was a cascade of water at 180 degrees Fahrenheit coming down the building into 34 degree Fahrenheit atmosphere. Probably somebody would have noticed. So this is why there's some speculation about where did JASCO get his information that he said was the basis for his recommendation to Congress.
You all will have to read some more from Atomic Insights to find out where I stand on this, because I do not believe the chairman had a basis for his statement, at least not a technical basis. There may have been some other basis. And based on some communications that I've had, he did not consult with technical experts within his own agency. So, anyway, let's go on to talking a little bit more about the communication effort. Gwyneth, what have you been doing? And you're wintering in the left coast, I believe. And
yes.
Tell us a little bit how you've interacted with some of your neighbors or friends or community members.
Well, I was interviewed by a woman who runs a green, I think it's called greenproject.com or something like that in the Bay Area near Berkeley. And because a friend of mine knows her and recommended that she talk to me, Betsy Rosenberg is the name of the woman. And so she had questions I would say are predictably Californian, which is, what about this terrible, horrible, absolutely devastating, world-changing event, and so on. And but very nice and a sincere person, and quite polite to me, even though in disagreement with my preference for nuclear power. And we had a good chat. And I tried to just explain some of the fundamental things that of the kind we've been talking about today, and to put things in proportion, to put radiation exposure in perspective, to put the plant failure in perspective, to talk about containment, and that this was being overblown. And she wound up saying, well, what you're saying sounds completely crazy to me, but since you are a green and your friend who recommended you was very green, I just have to think about what you're saying. So that was one communication. And then I just people I run into here, I don't, maybe I'm just different, but I keep telling people, don't take, I mean, a few days ago I was saying, don't take potassium iodide. It's not good for you to take if you don't absolutely have to, and there's no way the isotopes are going to make it across the Pacific. And most of the people said, yeah, I'm not doing anything about that. So, or they were going to ask their doctor or something like that.
Yeah. You know,
so the attitude is pretty good, and there have been informative articles in like the LA Times and so on about radiation exposure that are actually accurate.
That's good. You know, interestingly, I had some interesting emails. I'm on several private emailing lists in addition to the one that Dan discussed earlier, but a doctor who was asked about potassium iodide said, first of all, like you said, it's not good for you to take it if you don't really need it. And he said, in reality, what he's confused about is why anybody in Japan would benefit in any way from taking potassium iodine, since Japan is a nation of seafood eaters.
Yes.
They generally have pretty saturated thyroids to begin with.
Yeah. Unlike Chernobyl, where the natural iodine in the soil was extremely low, and there was before Chernobyl, there thyroid disease was endemic in the region. Mm-hmm. The Soviets provided potassium, not potassium, but iodine tablets to help with this, you know, endemic thyroid problems. And then they stopped providing it, so that when the radioiodine came out of Chernobyl, people's thyroids slurped it up because they didn't have iodine. They were not in Ukraine and Belarus anyway. They didn't get potassium iodide. In Poland, they did, and there was no uptick in thyroid disease.
That's an interesting comment. Hey, Meredith, I think you've told me a story about iodine and eating fish before.
Oh, yes. Can you hear me? Am I on mute, or can you hear me?
We can hear you fine.
Okay, great. I said that I thought that the fact that many people in Russia and inland areas like that consider having like a bit of pickled herring every week very important. I always thought, well, there's something to that, because that might be the only iodine source they have.
Yep. And like I said, it is completely different from a point of view of, you know, a nation on the coast where fish is a very important part of their diet, and a nation far inland, far from any, saltwater fish. Potassium iodine only works to fill your thyroid full of iodine so you won't absorb radioactive iodine, and it only works if there's radioactive iodine to be absorbed in sufficient quantities to hurt you.
Let me comment that we have a local sort of counterculture health food store over here in Vermont. We have several, but the one that's closest to me has been out of potassium iodide ever since this started. I mean, within 2 days, everybody had bought up all their potassium iodide. They're really concerned, apparently, that there's going to be such a threat cloud of radioactivity coming from Japan all the way over the Pacific, all the way over the plains, and in Vermont, you better be taking your potassium iodide. Things like this make me actually wonder if people are sane. I mean, it's very, that they might be against nuclear, okay, you know, they don't have the right information, but if they're actually putting themselves at risk, taking potassium iodide because of this fear,
Meredith? You can tell them two things. One is that potassium they're taking is mildly radioactive.
That's
and
point.
The other thing you can tell them is that when the plume came over California, where KI was sold out instantaneously already, but when the plume came over, some high-level detection devices, probably from the Air Force Base in Sacramento, flew up and took samples and found that the radioactivity had gone up in California 1/1,000,000,000. So there's a 1/1,000,000,000 uptake.
Did you hear what Leno said about it? It was hilarious.
No.
Leno on the air, after that was announced and people were running out and buying, he said, yes, everyone's running out and buying gas masks so they can go to the tanning salons.
Well, whenever I hear about this stuff, get reminded of an old song that I heard, because I grew up in the South and had a bunch of relatives of my father in particular who were quite fearful of people who were different from them and used the N-word on routine occasions, regular, every day, all the time, because they were afraid of people who are different. And there's an old song that says, you've got to be taught to hate, you need to start before you're 8 or something like that. I can't remember all the words, but that song haunts me when I hear about the fear that people have of radiation, because there's no way that most human beings are afraid of things they can't see, hear, touch, smell, or taste, and that has never actually hurt anybody they know. There's no piles of nasty-smelling radioactive material anywhere. You know, you have to be taught to be afraid of that stuff.
But no one's afraid of fine particulates put out by coal-fired and gas-fired plants.
Because they haven't been taught to be afraid of that.
Well, they're invisible, too. You don't know that you're taking them into your airways.
Right, but we have been taught, our society has been taught that somehow, and it's only man-made radioactive materials that are the ones you're supposed to be afraid of. If it's naturally occurring, you're not supposed to be afraid of that, although the human body can't tell the difference between a natural gamma and a gamma from something like cesium-137, which doesn't occur naturally.
Rod, I have a cousin who lives in Colorado, and her son has been living in, I think it's Crested Butte. Mm-hmm. It's way up in the high Rockies. And he's a young guy in his early 20s, and he's decided he and a friend are going to go to Japan as rescue workers or, you know, volunteers. And so my cousin emailed me about, she was concerned about his radiation exposure. And I said, please buy him a dosimeter, because I think that it's a very strong possibility that when he arrives in Japan, he will actually be reducing his level of radiation exposure by going to Japan and staying there.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I also communicate with one of the many mailing lists that I communicate with is a group that includes some folks who are very strong advocates of the notion that a little bit of radiation is not only not bad for you, but it's very important and good for you. And there are some treatments. Jerry Cutler, who's a PhD out of Canada, has been working with some folks in Japan for many years on using prophylactic exposure to what we would consider to be relatively high doses of radiation, and where you dose for, say, 5 rads to whole body or 5 rem. You wait for a couple of days, letting your body's natural response mechanisms rest and recover, and then you do it again. And he talked about a few folks who had cancer and were able to be put into remission by this whole body dose of radiation at levels that are above what you would normally, not necessarily dangerous levels, or say 5 Rankin or 5 REM, to your whole body, and which happens to be quite a bit lower than what you would get for, you know, the cancer type treatments. That we do the same thing when somebody's undergoing radiation therapy for cancer. They get very high doses with some rest, and then they go back for more.
It stimulates the DNA repair system, and one of the things Leo Gomez, a radiation biologist with some ties to Japan, told me was that they will give that whole body dose a few days before cancer surgery, and that reduces the probability of, you know, sometimes when you take out a cancer, you might actually release some cells into the bloodstream or something, and that this is a sort of prophylactic dose that they give people. And I think that if I remember correctly, they also give this pretty good dose, prophylactic dose before organ bombardment, you know, treating a particular organ. Mm-hmm. And it strengthens the rest of the body also. I'm not quite sure about that latter comment, though. I'd have to check with Leo.
Yeah, so one of the messages that I've been trying to share as widely as I can is that, you know, radiation is not something to be afraid of. It is something to understand, to use, to take advantage of. You know, I had people who were, you know, writing me, well, if they're not worried about radiation, why are they moving the workers back? And I said, typical response mechanism, time, distance, and shielding. You know, radiation workers understand that you can approach radioactive sources, you minimize the amount of time that you're there, you back away. And when I say, well, you know, we use time distance shielding, somebody said, well, if you're such an advocate of time distance shielding, why are you against evacuation? I said, well, I'm talking about distances of the difference between standing 10 feet away and standing 100 feet away, not the difference between standing, you know, 10 feet away and 50 miles away. There's a big difference, you know?
Yeah, I actually spent some time explaining the difference between radiation mm-hmm. and radioactive isotopic release
right.
with the reporter, because radiation is a near phenomena. That's the worker's risk of deep body gamma rays mm-hmm. if they get too close to the wrong stuff, versus volatilized isotopes spewing out the top and descending upon a wide area, which is the reason that you evacuate, is that second risk, not the first.
Yeah,
and getting them to understand that difference of time, distance, and shielding has to do with that 10 feet versus 100 feet.
Mm-hmm. One of the challenges that I have with things like these scary scenarios painted about used fuel pool fires. I'll say the word spent because that's what the world uses. I like used because it's not spent. It's still got 95% of its potential energy. But most of the material in that used fuel pool is very heavy, already oxidized material. It doesn't burn, and it doesn't get lofted very easily. Uranium dioxide is a very dense material. If it does turn into dust, it will fall out very quickly. It will not be volatilized. Now, some of the isotopes are gaseous, but they're gases like krypton and xenon, which don't react with anything. So if you do breathe them in, you'll breathe them right out again. They're not going to get absorbed and you know, turn into part of the chemistry of your body. There are a few isotopes that are different. Cesium and strontium are the ones that are really of concern, that do get absorbed and stay in your body and maybe cause doses over time. But you can measure for those things, right? They're not, you know, radiation is not something you need to be afraid of if you can't measure it. Because if you can't measure it, the doses are so low that it ain't worth worrying about.
Well, how serious is the cesium contamination in Japan? From a public health point of view?
So far, the reports from the IAEA say that the cesium levels found when they had this identified contaminated milk and leafy vegetables and onions, I think, spinach and onions, the cesium levels were below what's considered safe. So they're fine there. The iodine was somewhat elevated, slightly above, if I understand it right, somewhat above what is considered a safe level.
But when they say the safe level, they're talking. I said I saw somebody, and there were a few news media sources that did a pretty good job of trying to put that into context. And they said, if you drank this milk for a year as your only source of liquid, you would get a dose roughly equivalent to one CT scan. And if you ate the spinach for a year as your only source of leafy vegetable, you would get equivalent to one-fifth of a CT scan. And that's if you eat that stuff for a whole year. But you can't, because iodine-131 decays away with an 8-day half-life. So you couldn't eat this stuff for a year because it'd be gone in a year.
Right. The iodine worry is really quite specious there. There is a detectable increase in the amount of cesium, but again, it's well below the safe level.
And the spraying of the water reduces it also, right? Reduces the particles around the plant,
right. if it brings
them down into to the ground.
Right, and Rod will go after us, but we'll say if it aerosolized, I hate that word, if it got in the air, I hate using ized words because usually you're taking a noun and verbizing it. Okay.
We'll let the English majors correct you there, Mark.
I'm an engineer. I are an engineer. Anyway, if the cesium had gotten airborne from the pool, spraying the water definitely it scrubs it back out. It captures it. It's just like rain. That's why rain is sort of a good and a bad thing, is that it scrubs it right back out of the air, right back onto the ground. So that's exactly what the helicopters, if they had aerosols, that's what the helicopters were doing for them. So let's not argue about whether they did or not. If they did, that helped them.
Yep. If they did, I'll say that. Okay. Susie, you've been quiet because I've asked you to be on mute because you've got a funky microphone. But so tell me some of the activities you've had for producing some art. I think I posted your Honor the Nuclear Workers on my site.
Yeah, I guess when in doubt, my default is to just start making things. And so I came up with a few pieces of new imagery throughout this past week. One was to honor the nuclear workers, because on some of the blogs I was involved in, there were people just making bizarre and horrible comments about nuclear workers being selfish and greedy and inconsiderate to the public. And I just felt like it was a really inappropriate time for anyone to say something like that, and wanted to put a message out that, you know, these guys are heroes at Fukushima, and our guys at home are also heroes who work to keep the lights on so that we can all have prosperous lives. And we really need to be grateful for that right this minute, especially. And then I also worked on a few kind of educational materials, how to explain the situation at Fukushima to your children. I know a lot of parents and teachers were probably having a tough time, you know, dealing with this information themselves, much less putting it into perspective for their kids. So I really wanted to create something to help with that process. And one last image, just looking at the containment structure and trying to get some visual aid so that people could understand some of the terminology that was getting thrown around.
And you've been doing a great job. And it is so important to try to figure out various ways of getting information and making it available to people in such a way they can accept it. You know, I am so so confused sometimes about how to try to convince people that fear is far more deadly than radiation. And in fact, at Chernobyl, it was fear and overreaction and improperly ordered evacuations of perfectly good areas that is what caused most of the health effects from that accident.
Well, and I think you're right. I think one of the things that maybe was successful in dealing with this issue this week is that we didn't wait to communicate. A whole lot of different people stepped up to the plate and shared the information that they had in the best, you know, simplest way possible so that fewer people were scared. And I think that that really is going to change the way that all of this pans out in the long run.
Yeah, it is so important to not be afraid and to not panic. I attracted a few trolls to my blog this last few weeks, or last week and a half or so, who were, you know, calling me an apologist and claiming that I was, you know, representing the industry and putting a smiley face on things. And of course I ignored them most of the time. But one guy, after I wrote a post, said, you know, let's not panic. Let's think calmly through these things. You know, he would, every time he heard a bad news story, he would come, is it time to panic yet? No, it's never good to panic. Panic does not solve any problems. It causes you to have the fight or flight, and instead of fighting or flight or fleeing, you freeze. You know, panic freezes people. It stops action. It stops thought.
There's another thing about panic. This is based on interviews I did with psychiatrists and psychologists for an article a long time ago for the New York Times. And when people panic or they get very frightened, they are easily manipulated because they're in a kind of a trance. And they will start just doing stuff In other words, they become more submissive and stop thinking. So it's really important if you find yourself in a real disaster, a real cataclysm, to try to not panic, to not be afraid, because your judgment can cause a lot of, can fail. And you have to just kind of make yourself not be afraid in order to think and to do the right thing rather than what maybe the mob is doing.
And I can tell you that there are people, believe it or not, folks, there are people in the world who are evil and who are evil but study psychology just as well as people who are good study psychology.
That is true.
And they will manipulate that knowledge that fear causes people to become more easily manipulated. They will use that. They will turn people into people who are afraid so they can move the mob in the direction they want it to go.
I see this all the time in the media.
This is Dan. I want to just mention that whenever I hear a radiation scare, I think of the great cranberry crisis of November of 1959. In November 1959, the then Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, a man named Arthur Fleming, said that the Food and Drug Administration, which at that time was part of it, urged that there be no further sales made of cranberries or cranberry products produced in Washington and Oregon because of their possible contamination by a chemical weed killer. Now, supposedly this caused cancer in the thyroid of rats. The cranberry industry was devastated because cranberry products were removed from the shelves of grocery stores, menus of restaurants, and Thanksgiving tables of American families, including President Eisenhower, who also removed it from his menu. Turned out you would have to eat cranberries for a better part of a year every day in a considerable amount in order to duplicate the dose that the rats had received. So I want to just mention this cranberry paradigm in the context of panic, because it's a good way for listeners to have a kind of a checklist in their mind. Is this another cranberry crisis, or is this the real deal?
Or LR, what was devastated the apple industry in the Pacific Northwest not too long ago, was it? Maybe 15 years ago? ALR, is that right?
Yes, I remember that. You couldn't give apples to your kids or whatever. I don't remember exactly, but it was all terrible, and there was no hope for anybody if they,
Right, and again, that was a scare that devastated a very important agricultural industry. For I think they lost a whole season's worth of sales because there was some fear about the potential effects of the pesticides they were using. ALAR, I believe, is name. So, and sometimes, quite honestly, some of those fears are flamed by somebody who has a competitive product to sell. It happens. I have gathered several smoking guns over the last week and a half where, investor advisors were touting, hey, go out and buy LNG stocks because, stocks that are going to benefit by the increased sales of LNG to Japan, or people that are saying, hey, the windmills didn't fall down, or hey, the, if we had solar panels, we wouldn't worry about it, being flooded. Of course, that you wouldn't have any power either, but that's neither here nor there. One of the things that really encourages me is that we do have, as I have mentioned before, the ability now to choose our own front page. We don't have to, only pay attention to the three networks. We don't have to just, look at whatever the local newspaper chooses as the important stories of the day. We can find out all kinds of much better information by using the tools at our disposal. And it doesn't take very much searching to do that. One of the things that I've tried to remind people recently is there's a refinery that is still, at least as of yesterday, burning near Tokyo, at Chiba, Chiba, I think is how you pronounce it, the owners of that refinery cannot even come close to approaching the tanks that are burning because they're too hot. And that's been burning now for 7 or 8 days. And you can still find out the facts that are there, but there's not much descriptive information anywhere.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I tried to find out if there were any deaths associated with the refinery explosion, because when one explodes in this country, usually people die, and it's just being ignored, but it is still burning.
Mm-hmm. I suspect that they may never know that. If it was on the coast with the tsunami...
Yeah.
Well, actually, Chiba is not that close to the tsunami. It blew up because of the earthquake, not because of the...
Okay, well then they might be able, then they might be able to determine it. But anything that was in the path of the tsunami is going to be so messed up.
Yep.
Well, at one point, I saw a statement that a dam had failed and 1,800 houses had been wiped out. But I haven't seen anything about that since. I don't even know if it was, you know, it sort of came and it went. I have no idea if it was true.
It is true. And you can find that story if you go to the trade press for the hydroelectric industry.
Okay.
But it's not in the mentioned in the regular what people consider to be the top line advertiser supported media is what I call them, the people that who's depending on drawing eyeballs so they can sell products. You know, that what other folks call the mainstream media. They're just not interested. You know, and it's funny to me that the old saying in the media is, if it bleeds, it leads, seems to be ignored when nuclear issues are an option, because although nuclear issues haven't really caused much blood, and the very brief explosions, not followed by fire, have, you know, been played over and over and over again, you know, they only lasted about 30 seconds.
But it's a disaster movie.
It is. It's a Japanese
disaster
movie. It
doesn't matter that nothing's happened. The anticipation is killing them.
I just got a note on my blog saying that if the brave men of Japan can't control this, then it's going to, there'll be enough radiation to wipe out life on Earth. No, really. I just published it. What the heck? Somebody else will answer it, I'm sure. I'm getting tired tonight.
Is it that same jackass?
No. Well, unless he's publishing anonymously, because he finally said that he was going to never be on my blog again because it was futile. And I was like, oh, man.
Oh, good.
He finally got smart. But I have a feeling he's back, but he's anonymous. But I might just go to no anonymous comments. I don't know.
I actually had to do that. I made Atomic Insights require at least some form of login. It's pretty flexible what you can use to log in, but I stopped using Anonymous. I had one guy threaten to leave, and actually he said he was gone, and then he came back, and I said, I thought you were gone, in a comment back to him. I'm sorry. Sometimes I've been very sarcastic, but that's my personality. If people don't like it, they don't have to read my blog.
I wanted to bring up one other possibility. Japan, I'm told, has the third biggest economy in the world. Is it possible that other countries would be highly motivated to say that from now on it will be a radioactive wasteland and don't invest in Japan? In other words, rivals for economic reasons.
Oh, more nefarious than that. Think about driving the market to move when you've hedged for it,
right?
So
or when you sold short.
Yeah, sold short but basically hedged. So making those statements and encouraging that thought for short-term benefit, you don't really care if they don't rise out of the ashes, because you can say it's going to be an economic wasteland. If it's not true, ultimately Japan will come roaring back. But short move of the market certainly can happen on that kind of a statement.
Well, and you know, from a point of view of the nuclear business, it's extremely important to note that, you know, GE Hitachi, Toshiba, are two of the largest suppliers of the Generation 3 reactors. And, you know, Toshiba got hammered, which I actually thought was a great buying opportunity. So I now am a proud owner of even more Toshiba stock than I was before. I've also added to my holdings of uranium stocks because they got hammered. I still believe those are very valuable. And Shaw Group, a few other folks that are, that I think, are going to come roaring back. You know, matter of fact, as they used to teach us, and most people never understand this, but if there's any submariners in a group, you'll, or submariners in the audience, you'll know what I mean when I say you don't zig in position. So what that means is that if you think something's really changed, it generally hasn't. The direction may change, but position doesn't change overnight. The world still needs an awful lot of energy. The world still has limited sources of fossil fuels coming from limited places, which don't necessarily have terrific environmental impact. So the imperative for nuclear energy has not changed. You still will not power a modern industrial society with wind and solar. You can't. You know, I don't care what anybody says. No matter how good an engineer you are, you cannot make the sun shine, and you cannot make the wind blow. So, you know, you need to have something you can control in order to have modern industrial society. And I kind of like modern industrial society. I enjoy living in a place where I can flip a switch and turn on a light. I know how hard it is to make light come on if you are going to burn something to make it come on. Making candles was a joyous thing to do when I was a little kid in arts and crafts, and I said, you know, this is a real pain in the butt.
So. Well, I think just watching the images coming out of Japan should make most Americans really appreciate our modern comforts. At least I would hope so.
Well, and as I mentioned before, I've been through natural disasters where you don't have power for significant periods of time, days or weeks, and it is definitely not the kind of society I want to live in. I remember one of my little girls when they were little saying to me, "Daddy, I never want to live any place where there's no power." So.
Me neither.
That's true. And I don't even want to live any place where that somebody tells me that I can't turn on my power. You know, that they want a smart grid control me to turn off my power because they think I'm using more than my share at the wrong time at the wrong place. I love the idea of having power when we want it, where we want it, at the flip of a switch. It's a noble profession to supply that power.
So I have a bulletin here that's kind of good news. I wonder if I could break in here. Surface temperatures of the reactor, all six reactors, are below 100 degrees Celsius, according to Japan's defense minister.
Outstanding news.
The Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency says that using infrared sensing from helicopters for the second consecutive day, the surface temperature number one was 58, number two, 35. These are Celsius, by the way. Mm-hmm. Number three, 62, number four, 42, number five, 24, and number six, 25. All Celsius temperatures below 100.
This is the spent fuel pools?
This is the reactors.
No, this is the
reactors. The reactors, so the containment.
Yes, yeah. Right.
Okay. That's good. That's very good. You know, I was describing, if somebody asked me where all the seawater was going in the reactor, and I said, it's actually a giant thermos bottle right now. Mm-hmm. And I have this knack for those phrases that cause long silences on the other end of the phone.
What's the name of the dolls that the Russians make where you kind of open them up with different layers?
Nesting dolls.
Say again?
Russian dolls?
The Easter egg dolls.
I don't remember.
Yeah, no, there's a special name for him.
I think the special name is nesting dolls. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, that's what, you know, people get confused between containments, pressure vessels, cores, but that's really, you know, what you need to think about. You know, you've got these various layers, and the core, and by the way, I do want to make a point here. I don't necessarily agree with those who say that a reactor that has had seawater used to cool it down is dead forever.
Oh, no. Absolutely not.
The core may be dead, but we move cores out all the time.
The main problem, Rod, is that, first of all, the Unit 1 was scheduled for permanent shutdown in about 2 weeks anyway.
It did get a license extension, though.
They did a license extension in Japan?
Yes, they did. 10 years.
Okay. Wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, it happened it was awarded not too long ago, within the last few months.
But the problem with the cleanup typically is running around, there's a second factor, and that's the boron. These reactors, boiling water reactors, do not operate with boron in the water. They operate with clean water and boron in the blades, right? Mm-hmm. The problem with boron is it tends to plate out on everything. So if you cleaned the reactor out of the salt water and did a clear water flush, that would be good, but you'd still have boron coating everything inside. Getting it off again would be difficult and probably cause you to have to put some pretty high dose on people to get them in there to clean it. And it's probably more expensive than it's worth.
Yeah, but it depends.
But that's been my answer, is that it's not impossible. It's a cost-benefit question.
Right, and like you said, particularly since some of these reactors, all these reactors are between, 35 and 40 years old. So the amount of time that you'd gain is something you have to weigh very carefully. It's a cost-benefit equation.
Right.
Some
plus
may
typically
be worth it, and some maybe not.
Some maybe not. The Japanese also have a philosophy of operation of that was sort of the crux of some of the issues a few years ago in Japan, of like new. So they can't repair, they have to replace. And so if they get in there and they have to repair components, the general rule is that means they have to replace. Again, it's all a cost-benefit question. It's not necessarily that the reactor is dead. It's just you've mucked up the works with pretty impure water with this boron added to it. It's going to cause you a lot of cost to get it back online.
Margaret, let's talk a little bit about the boron. A lot of people don't understand why the Japanese were adding boron, and I think you had some good explanations on the ANS list. I wonder if you could share that with the listeners.
Oh, yeah, sure. The reason boron, first let's talk about the two different designs a little bit because it helps understand. The two different basic reactors are pressurized and boiling water reactors. Pressurized water reactors have boron in the water. Boiling water reactors do not, because it just doesn't work well if you do that. So you have these nice control blades that come in. They're cruciform shaped and they really shut the power down in the core. Lots of boron in these carbon blades shuts the core down, stops all the operation. But one of the problems is that if you're assuming you've got significant core damage, you now have pellets, potentially whatever's going on, but they're no longer in the position you thought they were in when you started. And so the Japanese rather wisely said, look, we're going to inject seawater to help cool it down, and we've got this tank full of boron. Let's just inject boron in at the same time so that if some stuff is not where it's supposed to be and it's piled up in a place we don't want, we kill it. Then there's a secondary effect, which I actually was unaware of, which is that boron will capture iodine. So it helps prevent that gaseous release of iodine if you do have a problem. So there was a double effect going on there. But I believe their main reasoning was sort of a belts and suspenders approach to this of, let's just make sure nothing's going on.
And that's a typical nuke approach.
Absolutely.
Belt, suspenders, and a pair of tight pants.
I told you guys will like this. I don't know if I've told this story. When I was setting up for one of my Skype interviews, the little tech guy on the other side was giving me, okay, now do this, then turn off all that, and then do that. And of course, I was already four steps ahead. And he says, you're very well prepared. Then I leaned into the mic and I said, don't tell anybody, but nuclear engineers plan for contingencies.
And with that, it's been a wonderful chat with you all. And we still have an awful lot of communicating to do. This event that does measure a 5 on the international scale is certainly not over. There are certainly lots of people who are still working hard to confuse the public, but there are other people who really are curious. They're recognizing that the sky didn't fall, it's still blue, it's not dropping radioactive material out, no matter what the Chicken Littles have said for so many years. And this is what we call a teachable moment. At least that's what I called it when I was teaching at the academy. Is sometimes it's hard to get people's attention. It's hard to get people to listen and even ask questions. But there are times when we have the opportunity to teach. When we have people's minds open. You have the curious folks who are saying, you know, I heard about all these scary stories, but really, nothing happened. And unfortunately, I think that the tendency of the advertiser-supported media is to say, well, nothing bad happened, we got lucky, so let's move on to the next crisis. And of course, as you all know, there is a very large and blooming international crisis going on in Libya now, where, you know, we started firing cruise missiles to suppress air defenses, and the international community is establishing the conditions that would allow it to do a no-fly zone. You have to get rid of the anti-aircraft defenses first before you can do no-fly, by the way. So, fortunately, and not surprisingly, the nuclear issues in Japan are starting to move way back in the lower priority, and people are focusing on how do we get food, fresh water, shelter to those people who need it. And that's what we really need to focus on while the guys who are at the plant have a lot of work left to do. So thank you all for participating.
Thank you for asking us.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you found that informative. If you are so moved, many of us have on our sites links to a fundraising effort for the nuclear workers and Japanese relief. Please visit and donate generously. Take care and come back for more.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way. Such a better way today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.